Welcome to the What Dreamers Do podcast. I'm your host, Carla Gover, an Appalachian musician, flatfoot dancer, mama, creative, and dreamer from Kentucky. I'm on a mission to inspire others to realize their dreams and live their most creative lives. Grab you a mason jar full of sweet tea or something a little stronger and pull up a chair, because it's time to get your dream on. Who's been following you? Because that's what dreamers do. Welcome, dreamers. I am so excited to introduce you to my good buddy, Andrew Bentley, who not only is going to inspire you with his vision and walking his talk of living a creative life, but he's also going to share a lot of information that is going to help us be healthier in our bodies, our minds, our spirits, and have a better, healthier connection with the earth and with the plants of this beautiful planet. In this interview, you're going to hear about his clinical practice, how he became an herbalist, and you'll come to see that he spent the time developing the Appalachian lore and heritage that he was given in herbalism in a similar way that I did with music and dance. And he's just kind of taken all of these traditions and run with them. He's a really special person to be around. His knowledge seems almost infinite. He's truly one of the smartest people I know. But he's really cool, too, because if you go to his house, often he'll feed you a meal that he's hunted the meat, foraged all the vegetables or the fruits in it. He's made cocktails and cordials out of plants and berries in his yard or in his nearby meadows or in the woods. And it's just a really special experience because he kind of has taken a lot of the things that he grew up with and was raised doing and learning from the elders in Appalachia and really experimented with them. So I can't wait for you to get to know him. This is going to be a two-part series. We'll be with you this week and next week. So let's just dive in and meet Andrew Bentley. Welcome, friends. I'm so excited to be here with you today, and especially to be here with my good buddy, Andrew Bentley, who is a practicing clinical herbalist living in Lexington, Kentucky right now. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
There are really so many things that we could talk about and probably that we will talk about this week. But since our podcast often centers around living a creative life and also Appalachia, and those are two themes that you touch on very deeply in your practice and your background, maybe we'll just start with talking about where you're from and how you got where you are today.
Sounds good. So I am from Eastern Kentucky. I'm from Lee County and an area called Bear Track, which is just a very rural area in Lee County. And so I grew up there in the 70s and 80s and then moved to Lexington to go to college in the early 90s.
Right. And I know that's definitely one thing when we met that I felt we had in common is that story of beginnings in Eastern Kentucky and moving to Lexington to get our education.
It's a lot of people.
My buddy Silas House calls us Appalachian expats. Yeah. So Lexington is full of Appalachian expats. But anyway, I think one thing that my listeners will be interested in hearing about is how you got your start in herbalism, since that's a big part of what you do in your life now. Like, what early experiences and exposures developed, cultivated that interest in you?
Okay. Well, my family had a tradition of using herbal medicine and using plants. And in the area that I grew up in, well, in my family, that tradition goes back to before we came to the United States. They were herbalists and healers in Ireland. And then in the area that I grew up in, herbal medicine was still very much a common part of daily life for most people. It was just something that people would use. People would use remedies from their environment rather than things that were store-bought. And so I learned a lot from just exposure being in that community.
So your family, I know you've talked about your father and your grandmother. sharing some of those skills with you. What are some of the first plants that you remember noticing or having pointed out to you?
So there are some that were really easy to recognize that I learned really early on, like oak trees, which, you know, you can recognize them because they have acorns on them and they have a pretty distinctive leaf shape, or at least most of them do. And dandelions, you know, some common weed type plants that are just sort of everywhere that are fairly recognizable were some of the earliest ones that I learned. Yarrow is another one. Yarrow looks like some other plants, but it has a real distinctive smell to it. And so that's one that I learned early on and still use a lot and have, you know, lectured about to national audiences and things like that.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing how intimate you can get with just a single herb, or how many different things you can do if you have an apothecary that just has like five or six herbs in it. The versatility and breadth of them is pretty amazing. And I know that's something I've seen you delve into, just not just using one herb for one thing, but using one herb for many different purposes.
For many different things. And that's, you know, here in my clinical practice where we're sitting right now, I have hundreds of different herbs, but growing up, I think, you know, my dad probably used 20 different herbs. And a lot of the people that we grew up around just used a few different things that they used for a lot of different purposes. And so, you know, if you have something like one of our traditional Appalachian herbs that a lot of people know is golden seal. And people used it for a lot of different things. People would use it topically to disinfect wounds. People would use it internally as a sort of laxative or digestive. It's very bitter, and so it kind of gets the juices moving inside your digestive tract. So, you know, there would be things like that that would have a lot of different uses that were not even necessarily closely related uses. And that's been typical. And I think you find that all over the world with people using plants, that they'll find multiple different uses for a single remedy, because unlike say over-the-counter drugs, which are a single substance with some other inactive ingredients, you know, there's a single active ingredient in most of them. Herbs have hundreds of different substances in them that are doing different things. And so you get a very different response from the body depending on how it's administered.
Well, that's one thing that I really enjoy about your approach to herbalism and that I've learned from you is, I think a lot of times in modern day thought, we think of herbs and herbalism as, yeah, it's really complicated. You need tons and tons of herbs. They're exotic. They're imported. They're from, you know, hot places or jungles, and they're mysterious. But as I understand it, the way you practice herbalism really has an emphasis on the local plants and the relationship that you have with those plants, and it's not super complicated.
Definitely. I mean, it can be as complicated as you want it to be, but there's definitely a strong tradition in herbal medicine, especially in like a more domestic variety of herbal medicine, of getting what's around you and gathering things from your environment and having a direct connection to your environment, which could be, you know, the garden where you grow things. It could be the woods around your house, or, you know, the pastures near your house in some people's cases, where you just go out and there would be plants that were there. And sometimes, a lot of the time, if you look at not necessarily what the people writing herbals and treating rich and famous people were doing, but what the common folk were doing with herbal medicine throughout history, a lot of the time it's things like cabbage leaves and garlic and things that were like more like a byproduct of their food production process that they had because they were, you know, gathering food. Raspberry leaves would be another example, even though that's usually a wild or wild-ish type of plant. People would gather or allow the bushes to grow so that they could gather the food from them, but they would also gather the leaves and use those as medicine. And so there's a lot of that sort of thing. And there's always been, you know, the exotic edge to it too, where there's, you know, myrrh or something like that that's brought from far away that has, you know, a sort of specialness to it because it's rare and because it's exotic. But a lot of the time you can do the same sorts of things with common weeds.
Well, the Stanley Brothers advertise for Martha White Flower, so I'm going to do a sort of cooking advertisement here to support this podcast. I have a confession to make. I love to cook from scratch, but many nights these days, I'm only cooking for my son and myself. When I'm busy and tired, sometimes it's a little bit too easy to get takeout, so I decided to try some of those meal kit boxes that I saw advertised, and I went through four different ones until I found the one that I like best, Home Chef. Every week, I get to pick four meals that I think my family would like, and they send the ingredients right to my door. This isn't processed food either. It's just healthy meats, fresh vegetables, and grains that I prepare. It usually takes me 30 minutes or less to get supper on the table, and my picky son loves every meal. Plus, it's way cheaper than takeout. If you want to try it out, just go to carlagover.com/supper. I don't get paid for this endorsement. I just truly like the product. And if you sign up using my link, they will send me credits toward my own boxes. And with an almost 13-year-old boy in the house, I could use them. Plus, all that good food is going to help me keep recording this podcast for you. Just do me a favor and don't tell Granny. Well, I love hearing about that, and I do want to, in a minute, get more into what you're doing now in your herbal practice, but I also want to touch on the past a little bit more, because it's really interesting. I remember one time when you and I did a gig together, and there was a performance at the end, and you'd been teaching the kids herbs all week, and I'd been teaching them music all week. And then at the end for the performance, you busted out some traditions from your family lineage that were, would you call it a bardic tradition?
Yeah, I would call it that.
Do you want to talk about that a little bit? Because it was so interesting.
So the in Ireland from really ancient times, medicine and music and prophecy were all considered sort of interlocking disciplines. So you'd have people who were, well, in ancient times, druids, and then later on bards and some other things. Sometimes they still called them druids, even up into the 1700s or so. But they were people who knew about medicine, knew about what you might call magic, and knew about history or stories, which were sometimes kept in the form of song and sometimes kept in the form of just prose, or sometimes prose with sung dialogue. That was actually a pretty popular format too. So there was a lot of that kind of, that was part of the family tradition. And then some of it, which I, you know, went back and learned some songs and things like that, that had been around in former times that weren't necessarily passed down to me through my family, but that I went back and learned about that were just sort of part of the same cultural tradition.
Right. And I think that's one thing that maybe Irish traditional culture and Appalachian traditional culture, I guess all traditional cultures really have that common thread of, it's very much something that you pass down in your family to your children. And I know that that's a part of what you've done with your daughter, Aoife. And in fact, it's really adorable because I remember when she was like 3 or 4 and you'd started teaching her these things, she went around all the time telling everybody, I'm a bard from Clan O'Mara. And now she's working with you, right? She's doing medicine with you.
She's making most of the medicine that I use in my practice these days. And she is doing some work with patients. She was doing a little bit more of that before the pandemic started, but now she's mostly doing the medicine making and making herbal candies, which is sort of her own project. And
oh yeah, that's really cool. Making them palatable for people that might not like the flavors of some of them.
Right. Yeah. Cause she herself doesn't really like the way the alcohol in the tinctures tastes, for example.
Okay.
And so she thought it would be nice to have gummies and things like that.
Well, that's awesome. To be passing it on like that, it means a lot. I know very well through the work that I've done with my daughters and passing down the music that I've learned. So I think another thing, so we know that you have this history. You know, we know that you've grown up in Appalachia. You have a family tradition of herbalism. Obviously, it's something that you took to and kind of studied on your own as much as you could. What other things have contributed to your eventual career in herbalism, like your education? I know you traveled a lot. I know you studied with some indigenous healers. Could you tell us about those things?
Okay, so early on, I didn't necessarily know that I was going to be able to make a career out of herbal medicine. My father and grandfather didn't really. It was just something that they did for people around them. But not as their main way of supporting themselves or anything. So at one point I studied molecular biology at Western Kentucky University for about a year and was involved in a research project there. And we were looking at the trypanosomes that cause African sleeping sickness and trying to figure out how they went about evading the immune system, which we didn't figure out, someone else did. But someone somewhere eventually figured it out. But so I got some background in chemistry and molecular biology from that. And then I started applying that to learning about herbal medicine because I understood it like this whole different language for how molecules are put together and what sorts of chemicals are similar to each other and might be expected to do different similar types of things to each other. And so I started kind of looking at it from that perspective, which is not a perspective that a whole lot of people in the herbal medicine world have. And then later on, I studied anthropology and linguistics at the University of Kentucky and went to post-Soviet Central Asia in the 1990s and did some field work there, learning about what sorts of medicines people used. So I was learning all of this stuff, and it was very interesting, but I still didn't necessarily have the sense that I was ever going to be able to make a living as an herbalist. My plan at the time had been to do computer programming for money and to have herbal medicine be something that I just sort of did on the side. And I did work as a computer programmer at Lexmark here in Lexington for a couple years, but I sort of hated it. It was kind of, you know, I was okay at it, but I didn't feel like I was really contributing anything special to the world by doing what I was doing there. And at the same time, there had been some changes in the herbal world, some regulatory changes that made it more explicitly legal to sell herbal remedies. And there had been a surge in popularity of herbal medicine. And so I started trying to do it as a living, and it worked out.
Well, I think from my perception, because I've watched your career emerge, because we've known each other that long, it is very interesting, and it does set you apart that you have not only the knowledge of the herbs that many herbalists have, like use this for that and use this other thing for that other thing, but you also have that scientific understanding of it too. And I know that you've done some work with the University of Kentucky lecturing on the herb drug interactions over there. So that's something. And then also the folklore side of it, though, the folklore and the traditions. And that's one reason I love doing herb walks with you, because, you know, one minute you'll be talking about, you know, the chemical compounds in the plant, and then the next minute you'll be talking about some arcane folklore from Ireland about that plant. And it's, to me, a really unique and well-rounded skill set for you to do what you do.
I try to be, you know, I feel like there are so many different aspects to it, and each one of them could easily be more than someone's life's work, you know. But I try to have a little bit of all of it, you know, or a decent amount of all of it, just to kind of have a more full understanding of things.
Well, the way you practice it, to me, it makes me think of you as an artist. It seems like more of an art than just a clinical or scientific thing. It's kind of like the total package. And I like the way that you sometimes describe yourself as the village herbalist.
Yeah, that's a term that I came up with pretty early on when I was when I first had come to Lexington. I was working a lot with people who were homeless or people who were part of the Rainbow Gatherings, which were just sort of like traveling hippie type people. And so I was working a lot with that sort of population who were not using conventional medicine as much. And that was sort of something that I half jokingly started calling myself at the time, you know, felt like a nice anachronistic job title. And it's kind of, you know, come to be more and more real as the years and decades have gone by. And as my practice has become more of a well-known thing here in town.
Well, it's very evocative. And if you were sitting here with me in Bentley's clinic, it definitely has the village herbalist vibe. I mean, there's mortars and pestles and jars full of roots and mysterious liquids and many shelves full of herbs and mixtures of various herbs. And I think one of the things that is really cool is the way that you forage your own plants and make your own medicines, because I was on the road somewhere and went to an herbalist, and I haven't been to too many herbalists because I usually come to you. And when I went in his office, I realized that all of his medicine, it was just, he'd bought the herbs from other places. And so I was like, wait, he didn't make his own herbs, but I guess that's not necessarily typical.
Right. I mean, a lot of herbalists do make their own extracts. I try to go an extra step and have just about everything I use be something that I've either grown myself or gathered myself, or in some cases had people gather or grow for me if it's something that won't grow around here. Like, for instance, the seaweed that I use comes from a company called Bla Namara that's on an island off the west coast of Ireland, and it's a multi-generational family that harvests seaweed from the ocean there. You know, we're a long ways from the ocean here in Lexington.
Yes. So,
but they're seaweed people, and they know how to do it properly and everything. And so that I try to get it from sources like that rather than from, you know, big companies or from places where I wouldn't necessarily know where the plant had been from the time that it was a living thing until the time that it's a finished product that I'm giving to a patient.
Yes. Well, I love the fact that you do make your own formulations. And one other question that I have is, how you learned about diagnostics, because it's one thing to know, you know, this herb is good for this ailment, but I know that many times when somebody's ill, they don't necessarily know what it is they have. So what process did you go through to learn about, you know, actually figuring out what it is that someone has?
Yeah, that's really the hard part of any kind of clinical work, I think, is the assessment. I don't really like the term diagnostic because I think it feels kind of superstitious to me, because it means like certain knowledge or whatever. And I tend to think of it more as a working hypothesis. But the process of assessment that I use is mostly based on asking questions and getting answers from the people, and then trying to figure out based on that what structures and functions in the body need additional support. So knowing about that requires, or being able to sort that out, requires a lot of study of anatomy and physiology and pathology to try and figure out, how to differentiate one condition from another. If somebody's, you know, having pain in their back, how do you figure out if it's muscular, if it's skeletal, if it's their kidneys? You know, there are lots of different questions that you can ask to sort of sort these things out. And, you know, learning to do that is really a big part of learning to do clinical work, whether you're an herbalist or, whatever you are. And so that's a long and difficult study for sure. And then, you know, I've incorporated some things into that process, like from, I use microscopy, for example, to look at cells. And that's something that I learned from doing molecular biology. And so, you know, there are parts like that that I've added in, but that's, I think that's an area where a lot of practitioners sort of fall short, where people are either just ordering tests and then saying there's nothing wrong with you if nothing comes back on the tests, or else doing some sort of hocus pocus, like, looking at the color of somebody's irises or something, or, you know, things that basically amount to divination to try and figure out what's wrong with somebody. And those things, you know, I don't feel like they're to be relied upon necessarily. Certainly I can't do them in a way that can be relied upon. Maybe someone can, you know, but, that is a long, hard process of learning how to do that, but it's mostly about sorting out what structures and functions are involved in a particular set of, symptoms or clinical presentations.
Well, I know a lot of people, or at least there's a popular conception I feel like that I encounter when it comes to quote unquote alternative medicine, which is that you have scientific Western medicine that is proven, and then you have this hippy dippy alternative medicine that's just kind of like witchcraft or superstition or quackery. And from hearing you talk and just from knowing what you do, it seems to me that you bring both this body of traditional knowledge as well as what you've learned from science into the mix. So what would you say about that?
I agree. I try to. With herbal medicine, I don't really think of herbal medicine as being alternative medicine. It's actually the mainstream of human healthcare on Earth. And what we think of as conventional medicine in our culture is, you know, something that's more available to people with more resources or in places that have more resources. And it's one difference is that herbal medicine is mostly not really proprietary. I mean, some formulas are, but the herbs themselves aren't really. And so there's not necessarily the financial incentive to market them in the same way that there is with drugs. But with a lot of herbs, there actually are lots of studies. For example, garlic has dozens of clinical trials that have been conducted on it and multiple systematic reviews of those clinical trials. It actually has quite a bit more science than your average prescription drug, backing up what it does and how it does it and the extent to which it can be relied on for different actions. That's true of several herbs, maybe dozens or maybe even hundreds of them, there are a lot of clinical trials. And then there are a lot more herbs that there aren't. And that has a lot to do with business, and that has a lot to do with whether or not that particular herb is popular in a society or a culture or a country that has a lot of power and money to do those kind of studies. Whereas if something were mostly used among a small population of, you know, people who did not have those kinds of resources, didn't have institutes that could conduct multi-center clinical trials, then, you know, you won't have that kind of quantitative data. But what you will often have is a very long clinical history of use. And so, for example, with some herbs, we have thousands of years of written history of use, because when people invented writing, some of the first stuff that they wrote about was medicine, herbal medicine with plants that they were using. So you have things going back to ancient Egypt. You have things going back to ancient China and stuff like that. And in other places, you don't have as long of a written history, but you do have an oral history. And you have a pretty good idea of what to expect from the plants from that. And often history of use tells us a different sort of data that we might miss in clinical trials, which are asking more specific, focused questions. So that's maybe a long and rambling response, but I think on the whole, it's important to remember that there is a lot of data backing the use of herbal medicine. Sometimes it's not the same kind of data that would be used to bring drugs to market, but there does tend to be a lot of information about it, and it's not this isn't a new thing. You know, it's something that people have been doing the whole time there have been people, and it's something that that there is actually a lot of available data on for people who care to look for it.
Exactly. Well, I think that it would be counter to the tenets of science itself to dismiss, as you're talking about, the extensive history of usage among human populations of certain herbs. So, I think there's ample scientific evidence in support of it. I guess I was just speaking to that popular notion that kind of tends to dismiss anything that doesn't have a white coat that you can't pay for with your insurance as quackery, you know.
Sure. Yeah, there's some of that for sure. And, you know, some people feel, you know, more comfortable with things that are presented with an air of authority and, you know, sort of an official blessing, I guess. But, like I said, a lot of people use herbal medicine and have for a really long time. So I think that it's, got its own sort of authority to it.
I hope you're enjoying this interview with my buddy Andrew Bentley. It was kind of long, so we're going to continue it next week. And we're going to go into what it's like to visit Bentley via a telehealth or in-person visit at his clinic. And then we're also going to talk about a lot of the amazing projects he has coming up, including his herbal school, as well as some of his publications and books that he has out already and that he's working on. But meanwhile, if you want to go check him out, if you want to gain some of his wisdom, he has a lot of stuff on the internet. You can find him on Facebook, which is at Kentucky Herbalist. You can find him on Instagram at Clinical Herbalist, or you can visit his website at www.kentuckyherbalist.com. If you enjoyed listening to this episode, it would mean so much to me if you would share it with a friend or two, send an email, tell them by word of mouth, or leave a review if you'd like. Anything that helps get the word out. This is all grassroots. It's a labor of love for me, spreading messages of hope and connection and building a better world. So if you would be so kind as to help me build that world by sharing this podcast with your friends, I would greatly appreciate it. We'll see you next week. And meanwhile, keep dreaming. This episode of What Dreamers Do is sponsored by the online Appalachian Flatfooting and Clogging Academy, the only course of its kind and the most comprehensive step-by-step program available for dancers learning this style. I teach beginning and intermediate students the steps and skills they need to dance to traditional mountain music so that they can be confident, joyful dancers and improvisers. Unlike others who just teach the same handful of steps or who just teach routines, I give you not only a bountiful library of steps, but a framework for understanding how the steps fit together with the music. Learn more about the Academy and get started for free with my video tutorial, The Three Essential Steps for Appalachian Flatfooting and Clogging. Visit www.carlagover.com today. It's a holy